This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, December 2nd, 2010. I'm Kyle Kellums. Walton Arts Center is expanding, an expansion that spans two counties.
It's a solution that follows our mission. It creates a regional performing arts strategy, meets our growth needs, and has a significant economic as well as artistic impact on the entire region and the state.
Peter Lane, the president and CEO of Walton Arts Center, made the formal announcement last evening after the center's board of directors approved the plan that will include a new 2,200-seat venue in downtown Bentonville and a new 600-seat location near the current Arts Center in downtown Fayetteville. The plan was one of two offered by the Facilities Committee, given the task to select a location for the expansion. The other proposal would have placed both the new 2,200-seat facility and 600-seat venue in Bentonville. Peter Lane told an audience in Star Theater last evening that the announced expansion would give Walton Arts Center the ability to offer a wide array of performances.
It allows us to do so many things. An expansion in two locations, a win for Northwest Arkansas, and certainly a win for the Walton Arts Center. This strategy, along with our plans to present concerts at the AMP at Northwest Arkansas Mall, and to work with the University of Arkansas to bring more concerts to both Bud Walton Arena and the Barnhill Arena, has the potential for major economic and artistic impact throughout the region. New theaters will allow us the freedom to program new and exciting arts and education programs in both Fayetteville and Bentonville, while also freeing up time for our current theaters for more programming by our fabulous local arts groups.
The vote by the board yesterday ended a portion of the process that included more than two dozen proposals for locations for expansion all over Northwest Arkansas. Reactions yesterday were generally positive, though the levels of enthusiasm varied. Fayetteville Mayor Lionel Jordan says he was a bit disappointed that Fayetteville was not picked for the larger venue.
Of course, you know, we wanted to see the major expansion down in Fayetteville, but, you know, we certainly need the 600-seat concert hall. I'll be pleased to see how it all works out, but once again, as the mayor of the city of Fayetteville, of course, I felt as though we had the best plan, and I'm sure all the other mayors did as well. So we'll get up tomorrow morning and see what we need to do.
Bentonville Mayor Bob McCaslin was a bit more upbeat after the announcement, saying his city is honored to be the new home of a 2,200-seat facility. The recommendation calls for the larger new hall to be located in or near downtown Bentonville, at a site yet to be determined. As Cool and the Gang song Celebration played overhead yesterday, Mayor McCaslin was asked if he or the city of Bentonville expected to be involved in some way with the site selection in Bentonville.
Well, I'm sure at some point I will when it's appropriate. Today's message is somewhat overwhelming, so I'm sure we'll move over to on-the-ground activities at a date to be determined in the future.
Peter Lane, the president and CEO of Walton Arts Center, says the two-city expansion plan is a boon for the University of Arkansas. He says additional venues will allow UA musical and theater ensembles to have more time to rehearse in halls and theaters before an actual performance date. And the expansion includes cooperation with the university to capitalize on Bud Walton and Barnhill Arenas as performance venues. University of Arkansas Chancellor David Gearhart says the use of Bud Walton Arena, with a possible seating capacity of 15,000 for a concert, has the university's backing.
There are many months that it sits, you know, somewhat idle. Now, we would have to be certain that our basketball programs are taken care of and that they're able, because that's where they practice. One of the things that we have on the agenda is to build a basketball practice facility. Once we get all that done, and that is on the front burner, I'd be delighted to have it utilized for, you know, big concerts, big name performances. We might have to do a little retrofitting in order to do that, but we could have a big concert in there now. We might have to make a few changes, but it would be possible. It would be, the problem is we'd have to give up space and practicing so they can, you know, get their trucks in and do all the modifications. But once we have the practice facility, that shouldn't be a problem for certain times of the year.
Chancellor Gearhart adds that Reynolds Razorback Football Stadium is another possible venue for concerts. Yesterday, Walton Arts Center officials stressed both Bentonville and Fayetteville locations would each host Broadway plays, concerts, and other performances. Acts likely to draw the largest crowds comedian Jerry Seinfeld was used as an example more than once, would be on the stage at the Bentonville Hall, while other types of entertainment, including jazz or dance, might be placed inside the new 600-seat venue in Fayetteville. And others that fall between might be in the current Baumwalker Hall that seats 1,200 people. Brian Crown, an owner of George's Majestic Lounge on Dixon Street in Fayetteville, and a sometime collaborator with the Walton Arts Center in promoting musical events, says he's happy his city is getting the 600-seat facility and that the larger building is headed north.
I don't think it would have been great to have a 2,200-seat venue here. I think the opportunity to have the 600-seat venue built here is going to open up so much more opportunity for the university, for promoters like myself, to have multiple venues to choose from. And the fact that some of the big shows will go to Bentonville occasionally will open up this main hall and even the Walnut Center parking lot for more events. You know, Neil Crawford and I that owns Jose's, we want to do a bluegrass festival, but it's hard to find dates. So it's going to really open up a lot, and I think we're going to actually probably see more business on Dixon Street with this decision being made in the long run.
Peter Lane, president and CEO of Walton Arts Center, says the adoption of yesterday's proposal isn't the end of the process, but another move forward.
Really, we're rolling up our sleeves now to go to the whole next level of work. The pre-planning work that needs to go into the next steps are enormous, but I think it's just one step in a long series of steps. It's the first step up on the ladder.
Lane says in the next few months, Walton Arts Center staff will continue to work with the center's facilities committee and board of directors to discuss specific sites, funding mechanisms, and other items. And there is more from yesterday's announcement on our website, including a sit-down conversation with Peter Lane about the expansion plan. You can look for the link at ozarksatlarge.com. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. The latest numbers indicate that, at least nationally, consumer confidence improved slightly in the past month. TheCityWire.com has recently participated in a poll of residents in the Fort Smith region to see if attitudes toward the economy are improving or not in our region. Michael Tilley is the editor of TheCityWire.com, and he joins me on the phone from Fort Smith. Michael, welcome back to Ozarks at Large.
Well, thanks, and happy to report on a little optimism out of our area.
This consumer sentiment poll indicates that people have a slightly more positive attitude now?
Correct. As part of our Compass report, we conduct a consumer Compass report, which we try to gauge what people in Crawford, Sebastian, Franklin, and Logan County, what they think about their personal situation and what they think about the local, state, and national economy. And what we found in a survey conducted November 29th, just a few days ago, that more people in this region say they are better off financially than a year ago, and fewer say that they are worse off. So the numbers aren't overwhelming. For example, only 12.5% think they're better off than they were a year ago, but still it's moving toward the positive scale.
Any indication what might have led to that slight, if only slight, but slight bump up in consumer confidence in the River Valley?
We have no idea. You know, we ask them also about what they think about the regional economy, what they think about the state economy and the national economy, and they, in fact, we ask them, do they think those economies will be better off, better or worse, in the next year? And regional residents were also optimistic about all three of those economies, saying that they would be better off in the next year. And fewer said they thought those economies would be worse. You know,
this poll, you surveyed more than 600 people in the four counties, right?
Yes, 640 respondents out of 18,000 in a pool of 18,000. And the survey, it's a scientific survey similar to those used nationwide. Talk Business Research and Hendricks College conduct the survey. And the CityWire, we're a minority partner in this survey system. And these systems aren't cheap, but they deliver us good results. And it's the first time that anyone in the Fort Smith area, any media outlet in the Fort Smith area, attempted to gauge what people in this region are thinking about their financial situation and the economy around them.
The CityWire.com covers Fort Smith city and regional politics, business, and news. Michael Tilley is the editor of the CityWire.com. Michael, thank you for your time.
Hey, thanks for having us on.
This is Ozarks at Large. This morning, Ozarks at Large's Ithi Egnihotri-Madolkar spoke with Dr. Reem Basuni from Georgetown University. Dr. Basuni is in Fayetteville today to present a pair of readings from her novel, The Pistachio Seller. The book, translated into English by Usman Nusari, won the University of Arkansas's King Fahd Center for Middle East and Islamic Studies Translation of Arabic Literature Award for 2009. The conversation between Ithi and Dr. Basuni took place in the Harold and Blanche Koch News Studio at KUAF.
First of all, congratulations on winning the award.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
The very first question that I'd like to ask you, to people who haven't read The Pistachio Seller, what is it all about?
It's really difficult for me to speak about my literature. It's very easy for me to speak about my academic books, but once I start telling the stories that I write, I become really embarrassed. But I think the Pistachio Seller is really about, it's a human story, and I always like to think about it as a human story rather than just a story of an Egyptian girl. But it's also about Egypt and all the changes that have been taking place, and perhaps not just in Egypt, but all over the world with globalization and, you know, the economic movement. But it's also about, you know, this teenage, unrequited love that perhaps all of us would go through at one point in our life, but this girl really took to an extreme. And, you know, the idea of this taking this passion to an extreme, and what really saved her is really her imagination. It's only imagination that managed to keep her sane until the end of the story.
You've written five other fiction books in Arabic.
Yeah, I write my fiction in Arabic and I write my academic books in English. It's very strange. And I don't think I can do either or in a different language.
Okay, so that gives me two questions. First, why translate the book into English?
I really wanted to get my books translated because I felt that I was writing, I'm going to give a better or more authentic view of Egypt and perhaps even the Arab world in general. Sometimes I feel, unfortunately, most of the literature translated into English is commercial in the sense that it is aiming at a specific market, portraying the political oppression or women oppression in the Middle East. But I didn't want to portray these things. I really wanted to portray the core things that, you know, Egyptians would be feeling, and perhaps they're not that different from what Americans are feeling, you know, whether it's emotions or whether it's love or whether it's hate or whether it's jealousy at some point or whether it's society and the restrictions of society. And I didn't want to speak about men or women. I just wanted to speak about the human experience. And I really wanted this human experience to be able to reach a wider audience and not just an audience that speaks Arabic.
How did the collaboration with Usman Nusayri come about?
It was really great because I knew him. He was my colleague. He's actually a Sudanese British, sort of very. And we have known each other for some time. He's much older than I am, and he has been writing stories himself. And when I asked him to translate this work, he said, "Yes, that's really, because that was his favorite novel of all my work." So he really was very happy to translate it, and he was really wonderful in the sense that he felt that I am the author, and since I know English, then I have the right sometimes to sort of change things that he has, you know, written. So I think it went really extremely well.
Why didn't you translate your own books into English? You write academic papers all the time.
Yeah,
English.
This is a very good question. And I have been thinking about it myself, and I really tried, but I think I feel like I'm too close to the text to be able to translate it. So sometimes if you feel so much for the novel itself, then it's very difficult to, you know, be able to be a bit far away from the text and try to translate it. It was very difficult for me to do that. I can't do it objectively, basically. And it becomes very difficult and time-consuming. And I would rather be writing a different novel at the time than actually translating it. So, but then again, there is also this challenge of someone else having different... He's going to still, you know, put something of himself in the novel, which is, you know, it's a little bit difficult for a writer, but it went on fine, so it was good.
As a person who can speak both Arabic and English, you must know that there are certain ways of saying things, idioms, old sayings, which you cannot translate them very accurately into English. How close would you say the Arabic manuscript is to the English translation of The Pistachio Seller?
This is, again, it's a very important point. I think it's really difficult to be able to get the feel for the English language if you're not a native speaker. And Osman is a British Sudanese, so for, to some extent it was very difficult for him to render this kind of poetic, for example, Arabic. And I think that perhaps to me is the thing that I feel a bit lacking in the translation, the poetic Arabic. You know, the Arabic was very, was much more poetic than the English. But then again, it, was it possible to get the, you know, the poetry in English, or was it just completely impossible? Otherwise we would have changed the meaning altogether. And that's always a problem for translation. How close or how far could you be from the text? And you know, you want to be very true to the text, but at the same time you still want it to sound as if it's natural. So
I know a little bit of Urdu. Correct me if I'm wrong. Wafa in Urdu means loyalty.
Yes, it's the same in Arabic.
Great. Okay. And Ashraf in Urdu means highborn.
Yeah, it's the same exactly in Arabic, it seems.
The pistachio seller, the female protagonist, is Wafa, and the male protagonist is Ashraf. And both the names almost define their characters. Wafa is extremely loyal in the beginning to her beliefs. She's extremely loyal to Ashraf. Mm-hmm. And Ashraf is a highborn who does not know anything else but good money and good living. Was that deliberate?
I mean, to be honest with you, it wasn't actually. No one would believe this.
I wouldn't.
Yeah, I think with Wafa, it's just that I liked the name and then I wrote the name. And then, you know, while I was writing the novel, it suddenly, you know, occurred to me that, oh, that's actually a very good name for the character. So, but it wasn't actually deliberate at the beginning. And the name Ashraf, I always had in my mind.
Which character are you most close to?
There are things I like about Wafa, and there are things, of course, I don't like about Wafa. And sometimes, you know, the kind of rigid ideas she had at the beginning, mm-hmm. I didn't really like. But I felt that I should really write about that because it occurs, it happens. And then, but then the passion that she has, and this kind of insistence and persistence on a specific aim and being able to get there, I really like that. I thought, you know.
Okay, as a writer, of course, you've written the whole book. Is there any specific part that is one of your favorite?
I really like the part when he is speaking about obtaining this American passport and what it means to him. And this, you know, identity issue. Because we live at a time when we don't just have one identity anymore. All of us have, you know, conflicted identities, multi-layered identities. And Ashraf is just one of these people in our times who perhaps, you know, feels Egyptian, British, and then American. And, you know, I was very interested to see how he's going to be able to cope with all these identities. And I was very happy with this part specifically. And I kept rereading it to myself.
Is there any particular line in the novel that is your favorite?
Actually, I sort of like everything really about it. But I remember an American friend of mine, and she mm-hmm. said to me that she read to me a passage of the novel, and she said that she really liked it very much. And it was this idea about extremism in anything. And she said, you know, that Wafa had suddenly this kind of enlightenment when she said, every extreme idea destroys, you know, the person who believes in it. And she then realized that, oh, the people, there are so many people around her who have these kind of obsessions with one specific thing, and it really is destroying them. And it's mm-hmm. not necessarily part of any religion, nor is it really part of a kind of good, healthy life. And I think I really liked that line very much, now that, you know, this American friend has told me about it.
Probably a lot of things can be explained by that single nugget of wisdom.
I think so. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here. And
thank you. Thank you so much for reading it.
Thank you for the interview, too.
Thank you.
The first reading and discussion of Dr. Reem Bassouni's novel, The Pistachio Seller, will be in Kimple Hall, room 305, that's on the University of Arkansas campus, this afternoon at 3:30. A second reading begins tonight at 7 at Nightbird Books on Dixon Street. Both events are free to the public. The book, translated into English by Usman Nusari, won the King Fahd Center for Middle East and Islamic Studies Translation of Arabic Literature Award for 2009. Ithi Agnihotri Madolkar talked with Dr. Reem Bassouni this morning in the Harold and Blanche Koch News Studio at KUAF. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is P.J. Hrabowski, music director at KUAF, and the host every Friday, including tomorrow, of Film Score Friday on KUAF. Welcome back, P.J.
Thank you, Kyle.
What soundtrack do you want to focus on today?
A really, really old one before anybody was born. It's called Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And it was a 1977 science fiction film written and directed by Steven Spielberg. Now, the movie stars Richard Dreyfuss, François Truffaut, Melinda Dillon, Terry Garr, and Carrie Guffey. And it tells the story of Roy Neary, who is played by Dreyfuss, who is an Indiana electrical lineman whose life changes after he has an encounter with a UFO. Now, in addition, the U.S. government is also aware of the UFOs, as is a team of international scientific researchers. Now, you've seen this movie, right?
You know what, though? I have not seen it since I saw it in the theater in 1977.
Wow.
I haven't seen it for 33 years.
I think I've seen it once.
I remember
then.
There's mashed potatoes involved. Doesn't he build something out of mashed potatoes?
Yeah, that hill
right.
that he sees. Yeah.
Right.
Now, if not for the misfortune of being released later in the same year as George Lucas's Star Wars, mm-hmm. Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which is also referred to as CE3K.
I did not know that.
I did not either. Could have resonated with the same appeal in our minds. Now, while both films feature science fiction stories at their best, as well as Oscar-nominated scores by the same composer, mm-hmm. John Williams, the CE3K is a bit more contemplative and at times quite a scary alternative to alien introductions. Now, the Spielberg story combined fears of alien kidnapping with the uncertainty of facing and communicating with a far superior species. Now, this reminded me, the beginning of it, Kyle, reminded me a little bit of Jaws. Remember, in Jaws, at the beginning, you hear the music, the doo-doo, mm-hmm. you know, and you see people kind of writhing in the water and stuff, but you don't see the shark. And so it's this kind of fear of the unknown. Well, the same thing happens in the beginning of Close Encounters because I'm not talking about the spaceship. I'm talking about aliens. You never really see the aliens at the beginning. You just know they're there. And you have this abduction, but you don't, you see the lights, you know, and all that, but you don't, you know, so you have this fear of what's to come, but you never really see it at the beginning. Now, while the suspense of the story dominates its first half, the actual military encounter with aliens at the end is conducted very successfully with the help of communication through lights, colors, and music. Now, because of this, Spielberg needed to identify a short musical motif early enough that he could use it during the production of the film's final half hour. Because you use that music.
Over and over, right.
Right. You know, in a lot of movies, you don't even know the film score until afterwards. You might even see a trailer that has film score music from another movie. But they couldn't do that because they needed it, you know, to produce the movie. Well, because of this, the collaboration between Spielberg and Williams, remember, is still very young at this time, and Williams had to convince studio executives that he was far enough along with Star Wars to contribute his best to Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Well, he sat down with Steven Spielberg several times for the purpose of coming up with and agreeing upon a five-note greeting that humans would use to solicit a response from the space aliens. Williams said, well, I was thinking more along the lines of when you wish upon a star, which is 7. And he actually did weave a little bit of that into the final minutes of the score. And despite his request to use 7 or 8 notes to form the greeting, Spielberg said, absolutely not. I want a 5-note limit. After all, the word hello is 5 letters long, right? Close Encounters is a score with 3 distinct parts. You have the first act, which has lengthy sequences of atonal and dissonant passages that accompany the kidnapping and mysterious hints of alien presence. The second part, explosive action, and then the third, and mine and many people's favorite, the communication sequence. And you have this conversation between the human keyboard operator and the mothership. And it's fun to listen to, and it's, you know, it's probably one of the most exciting parts of the movie because you have this, you know, the spaceship answering and then all these lights and noise. And with watching it, it's very exciting. Now, if you're listening to it on its own after about 2 minutes, you might want to commit yourself to an institution. It's not one of those film scores you'd want to listen to without the movie, at least for most folks. The score simply contains way too much atonal, ambient material to be a great listening experience. Now, if you're looking for a Close Encounters recording separate from the film, I would recommend the 21-minute suite that's recorded by Charles Gerhardt and the National Philharmonic Orchestra, and it's on the BMG label. And it also includes music from Star Wars.
So Close Encounters, the non-atonal version of Close Encounters tomorrow on Film Score Friday. What else?
We'll also hear music from The Horse Whisperer, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows.
That's the latest, right?
Right. We just got that in. Charade, East West, Presumed Innocent, Man in the Iron Mask, the latest one with Leonardo DiCaprio. Right. And Above and Beyond.
Film Score Friday tomorrow from 10 until noon on KUAF. PJ, thank you.
Thank you, Kyle.
Callas, the legendary American soprano opera singer, was born in New York on this date in 1932. The U.S.-born Greek moved to Greece with her mother in 1937. 2 years later, she made her debut there. She gained an international reputation for her performance in La Gioconda at the 1947 Verona Festival. She continued to sing heavy dramatic roles, including Puccini's Turandot and Richard Wagner's Kundry, until the conductor Tullio Serafin convinced her to shift to the bel canto repertoire, for which she became famous. Her signature role was Vincenzo Bellini's Norma. Though her voice was imperfect, her extraordinary range, dramatic stage presence, and mastery of difficult roles made her the most famous opera star of her day. Her fiery temperament and her flamboyant and demanding personality made her an international celebrity. She was the consummate diva. Author Thyra Samter Winslow passed away on this date in 1961. Winslow wrote more than 200 stories published between 1915 and 1955 in the heyday of American popular magazines. Her early life in Fort Smith provided background for her view of small towns as prejudiced, hypocritical, suffocating places. She was a principal contributor to Smart Set, and some of her work was collected in books. In 1960, she visited Fort Smith for the last time. Later that year, she was paralyzed by a fall and remained hospitalized until her death. Her funeral was at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York. She had converted from Judaism to Catholicism during her last illness, and she is buried in the Gate of Heaven Cemetery in Westchester County, New York. The first savings bank in the United States, the Philadelphia Savings Fund Society, opened on this date in 1816. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
There will be a couple of hours of musical heaven tonight at Good Folk on Block Street in Fayetteville. At 7:30, the Waymores will begin a house concert, and those in attendance will hear a delightful mix of pop, Americana, bluegrass, and more. The Waymores are Don Henry, Sally Barris, and Tom Kimmel. Individually, they've each written wonderful songs, and the combination of their talents combines their clever lyrics, their masterful instrumentation, and beautiful harmonies. The Waymores drove in from their homes in Nashville late last night, and this morning they came to the Furman Garner Performance Studio at KUAF.
I want to first ask about the name, because there is a sort of Ramones-esque feel to this, right?
Thank you. I love it.
I like that.
Awesome. You know, because there was Joey and Dee Dee Ramone.
That's right.
I like the way he thinks.
Yes. And Willie Waymore.
Yes.
Yeah. So you kind of, you know, have this familial pseudonym.
That's right.
Yeah. There's a whole lot about this group that's familial. For better and for worse, really.
Oh,
well,
boy.
I don't know who's Joey in this band. Probably Tom. Tom is now referred to as Pops Waymore, Tom Kimmel.
And so, Don's Willie Waymore.
Yeah.
And, of course, Sally is kind of like our little sister, so we call her Sister Waymore.
Sister Waymore.
Well, I think a great way to start this is you all three have guitars in your laps. Would you like to perform a song?
Yeah.
Our most Ramone-esque
song. Yeah. Oh, good. Well,
we wrote our own theme song. We thought it'd be fun to have a theme song. So it's called Waymore.
It's called Hey, Hey, We're the Waymores.
All right. One, two, three. Buddy's telling you a whole pack of lies. That crazy biker doesn't have a clue. He's more excitable than Barney Fife. Hell of a deal, and you know it ain't true. He's a puppet, he's a clown. He wears suspenders and a monkey suit. Just using you to make his mama proud. You mean way more to me than that. That little joker stole my lube machine. Now I have to pay a drummer to play. He skipped a tab on his gasoline. Sheriff tracked him down in San Jose. He's so sour, you're so sweet. What makes him think he's any good for you? I'd bring you flowers and I'd kiss your feet. You mean way more to me than that. At the county jail, I hear he's trying to get in touch with you. I bet he thinks you're gonna make his bail. You mean way more to me than that, girl. You mean way more. You mean way more to me than that, girl. You mean way more. You mean way more to me than that.
That's just infectiously good.
Oh, that's, good.
Yeah, there's good. There's a lot in there. There's a little bit of a touch of like Nick Lowe in there.
Yeah, we love Nick Lowe.
Yeah, that's I like how you guys were all just completely beaming at each other and with yourself. You were having a good time.
Yes. You know, we had a long drive, and then you get here and then you start playing music and you go, that's
right.
Why we do this. We love music.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. We've got Alabama native,
Minnesota native,
California native. you grew up in three distinct parts of the country: Upper Midwest, Deep South, the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Have you discussed? Were you listening to the same things and getting same influences?
A little bit. I think that's why there's a cross section. You know, you mentioned Nick Lowe earlier. When we first formed this band, we thought rock pile. We were thinking like that. So we all connect somewhere, but we all have our. When you hear a solo record, you can see that we have a whole different thing going on. So this is a really fun cross section, I think.
You're going to be a good folk tonight. House concert. It's as intimate. I mean, some people will be as close to you tonight as I am right now.
Yep.
And when you're playing and you're smiling and you look out and you see people smiling or tapping their feet, you know, there aren't the bright lights, you know, making their faces that you can't see them. Do you get more out of that? Oh, do you get more energy out of that?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. That's when it really happens.
You know, when I first heard about house concerts, I thought, has it come to this? But, you know, but I have to say, you know, I mean, I really enjoy playing house concerts. And the ones like Mike's, I mean, that's really done right, you know, where people can see and hear and got good sound and people are used to coming and hearing something special, you know, even if they're not familiar with it. I mean, nobody's heard us. Everybody's hearing us now for the first time. We've done about 60, 70 shows together. Sometimes we have individual fans, but nobody's heard this trio. But people come because they'll trust that, hey, they saw somebody they loved there last week or last month. That's really what community grassroots music is. A lot of it's based on. It's just kind of a high expectation you're going to get something unique and special.
Yeah. Can we hear another song?
Yeah.
Great.
Absolutely. This will be the Minnesota bluegrass influence in the band.
Just great.
Thank you.
Waymore's tonight at Good Folk House. First, that starts at 8?
At 7:30.
At 7:30 tonight. You guys are so talented. You each have written so many great songs, covered by other people. I often wonder, when you're in a town like Nashville, in a city with Nashville, where you can't swing a mandolin without hitting a talented songwriter, can you keep jealousy in check when you hear a great lyric or something? You go, oh, man.
Absolutely not.
No, you can't.
No, that's what's great about it, though. That's the fuel for it. Since I've been to Nashville, it's a twist to the word jealousy. It becomes inspiration, and you use it to go home and write a better song yourself. That's what makes Nashville so special to me.
When you say to somebody, "I hate you," that's a compliment.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, we all teach songwriting, you know, here and there, together and separately, and workshops, retreats, and one-on-one. And I mean, I've told my students before. I said, look, if I go over to the Bluebird one night and I hear Don or Sally play a new song that just knocks me out, it's just I'm aware of where the bar is, you know, for what really good is, and it really is inspiring. It's really inspiring.
How about one more?
Sure.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
This is called Singing Like a Bird, BYRD. You'll catch on right away. Surrounded by those big blue skies of youth, when DJ spun the rising sun of truth, I was flying 8 miles high in love, and it felt as if the whole wide world was singing like a bird, ringing like a Rickenbacker, sweetest sound I've heard. Innocence of rock and roll, the innocence that stirs my soul. Everything it touches turns to gold. You think by now that we'd have found our way, but the future's drifting backwards every day. The more we know, the more we're going down. Does anybody miss that hopeful sound of singing like a bird, ringing like a Rickenbacker, sweetest sound I've heard. The innocence of rock and roll, the innocence that stirs my soul. Everything it touches turns to gold. Our radio's been bought and sold away, but flowers through the cracks still find a way. Young town criers ring the Rimney bell, and it sounds to me like love and peace are still alive and well. And singing like a bird, ringing like a Rickenbacker, sweetest sound I've heard. The innocence of rock and roll, the innocence that stirs my soul. Everything it touches turns to gold. The innocence of rock and roll, the innocence that stirs my soul. Everything it touches turns to gold. You know.
Tom Kimmel, Sally Barris, and Don Henry collectively are the Waymores. They perform tonight at 7:30 at Good Folk on Block Street in Fayetteville. You can learn more about them at their website, waymorecounty.com. More information about Good Folk can be found at goodfolk.org or 521-1812. And for more information about Tom Kimmel, Sally Barris, and Don Henry individually, you can just put a .com behind their name. Links will be available at ozarksatlarge.com. Local support for Ozarks at Large comes from the Arkansas Yoga Center, with over 30 classes a week in yoga, tai chi, zumba, and meditation, promoting well-being to the community. aryoga.com or 521-9642 for class schedule and more information. And Westwood Gardens, offering a variety of Westwood-grown poinsettias, as well as live Christmas trees, wreaths, and garland. With four locations in Northwest Arkansas, westwoodgardens.com for more information. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Blue Eye, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF has proudly served as your source for NPR programming for the past 25 years. And remember, you can listen online at KUAF.com. For more information about Ozarks at Large or to listen to past programs, you can go to our website, OzarksAtLarge.com. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for tuning in. If we haven't given you enough ideas of what to do tonight already, don't forget, I'll be moderating a preview of the next Theater Squared production, which is Every Christmas Story Ever Told. That takes place tonight at 6:30 at the Fayetteville Public Library. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great Thursday.